Chapter 8. Divine Sex. In a modern, airy building in Jerusalem, there's an astonishing woman. She has long, thick hair sweeping down over her shoulders to fall between her breasts. There, twin babies are carefully positioned, their tiny faces turned towards her nipples. She meets the eyes of anyone who looks at her, her face tenderly expressive, her eyebrows slightly raised. Her arms are long and slender, the colour of warm sand. She extends them down the length of her torso, her wrists dressed with bangles, her hands coming together to meet between her legs. Large, leafy tattoos cover her thighs, stenciling her skin with ibexes, nibbling budding trees. She holds open her labia, revealing the dark, long opening of her vagina. Her gaze remains steady. She is the wife of God. This beautiful clay figurine was found in the excavated remains of a late Bronze Age site in the Shephelah region of what is now modern Israel. Dated to the 13th century BCE, she's a manifestation of the high goddess venerated across the southern Levant, an image inexpensively crafted for her worshippers to use in their rituals at home. She was a divine revealer of the secrets of new life, whose open labia manifested a powerful liminality, the inside and outside, entrance and exit place, at which sexual potency, fecundity, and birth were located. But in Jerusalem's Israel Museum, her open labia signal that she is little more than a commodified sex object. This figurine may represent Asherah, the sacred prostitute, reads the notice positioned next to her in the display case. It's a shocking and misleading caricature, grounded in a centuries-old, biblically-derived hostility towards the goddess once venerated as the traditional consort of Yahweh, the God of the Bible. This hostility seeps through the pages of the Hebrew Bible. In its story of the religious past, the worship of the goddess called Asherah is well known. Her statues and symbols are frequently said to stand in temples and sanctuaries across the Iron Age kingdoms of Israel and Judah. But her cult is presented as an abhorrent manifestation of the foreign polytheism polluting the land given by Yahweh to Abraham and his descendants. It's a religious deviancy repeatedly likened to sexual malpractice, so that those idolatrous Israelites and Judahites who stray after other deities are accused of whoring after them, sprawling beneath them, getting hot and acting as an adulteress in betraying their exclusive commitment to God. Metaphorically but authoritatively coupled in the Bible with female prostitution and promiscuity, the veneration of Asherah was consequently imagined by older generations of scandalized historians to have been little more than a titillating sex cult, in which the goddess functioned as a divine patron of open-air orgies and sacred prostitution, for which there is no compelling evidence. But the sexualized language of the biblical slur against Asherah was adopted unquestioningly as historical fact, giving rise to the distorted assumptions regurgitated alongside the goddess figurine in the Israel Museum today. More recently, however, Asherah has been rehabilitated, and scholars are now widely agreed that she functioned traditionally as Yahweh's consort. As a number of biblical writers inadvertently confess, his temple in Jerusalem housed Asherah's cult statue. Her cult object, a stylized sacred tree, was planted or positioned next to his altars, and kings and queens of Israel and Judah sponsored her worship in their royal sanctuaries. These admissions on the part of the biblical writers are striking. They demonstrate that even their own account of the religious past, as distorted with bias as it is, could not completely ignore so important a goddess. Asherah's pre-biblical career is best known from late Bronze Age Ugarit, 1550 to 1200 BCE, where she was known as Atherat. Here, she was the powerful wife of El and the mother of a major group of deities known as the 70 Sons, indicating that her partnership with El was extremely fecund. But her role was more than maternal. As El's partner, she was a powerful intercessor, mediating debates and disputes between the gods and petitioning her husband on their behalf. And yet she was more than the first lady of domestic politics. She was also known as the Lady of the Sea and the Lady Who Tramples the Sea Serpent, titles suggesting she once played a role in the ordering of the cosmos by commanding or subduing the watery monster with whom so many other deities would later contend. Her influential role in the human politics of Ugarit was also celebrated in her function as a divine wet nurse to Ugarit's kings, who relied on her to nurture and endorse their dynasties. As an ancient goddess of the highest calibre, her presence in the mythological story worlds of her worshippers underscored the authoritative status of the male deity with whom she was partnered. As a Therat of Late Bronze Age Ugarit, this was Ael. And as Asherah in the Iron Age kingdoms of Israel and Judah, this was Yahweh. While Asherah's relationship with Yahweh is usually presented as an abomination in the Bible, a collection of ancient Hebrew inscriptions sensationally unearthed in the 1960s and 1970s confirms her role as his consort. Dated to the 8th century BCE, these inscriptions present Yahweh and Asherah as a divine power couple petitioned for protective blessings by their worshippers. One inscription was found above the entrance to a high-status rock-cut tomb at Kerbet El-Khom in the West Bank. It confers a blessing from Yahweh and his Asherah upon the dead occupant of the tomb, a wealthy man named Uriyahu, who requires divine protection against those who might ransack his grave and disturb his peaceful existence in the underworld. At the same time, other Hebrew speakers were scribbling appeals to Yahweh and Asherah on votive pottery at a desert way station at Kuntalet Ashrud, a stopover site on a network of ancient trade routes crossing the Sinai. These inscriptions are among a number of petitions scrawled by travellers to secure the blessings of various regional deities for their family and friends at home. Their messages are addressed to gods residing in particular temple locations, including Yahweh of Samaria and his Asherah, and Yahweh of Teman and his Asherah. These appeals to distinctive, localised manifestations of the divine couple indicate that the pairing of Yahweh and the goddess was common in sanctuaries across the area. Taken together with the Kerbet El-Khom tomb inscription, these appeals suggest that most Yahweh worshippers did not share the biblical writer's derogatory view of Asherah. Rather, they considered her to be the traditional partner of their high god Yahweh, and they worshipped her as a protective, life-giving goddess, able to mediate divine blessings to Yahweh's people. But the protective force of Yahweh and Asherah was unable to withstand the onslaught of imperial invasions in their homelands, and it was Asherah who paid the price. Her state cults waned in the aftermath of the Assyrian assault on the Kingdom of Israel's capital, Samaria, in 722 BCE, and the later Babylonian destruction of Judah's Jerusalem temple in 587 BCE. Although there's some evidence to suggest that Asherah worship continued in some forms at these and other sites, the imperial destruction of these tiny kingdoms and the devastating desecration of their temples irrevocably damaged traditional religion and the local networks, political, economic, and social, on which it relied. Asherah would never recover her prestigious position as a state deity and the consort of God. In the late 6th or early 5th century BCE, when Persia was the dominant imperial force throughout the Levant, an elite group descended from Judah's exiles living in Mesopotamia was granted permission to return to Jerusalem and rebuild Yahweh's temple. But in remaking their temple, they also remade their religion. The traditional polytheism of the past was remodeled in the image of what's sometimes described as an emergent monotheism, but is more accurately understood as a radical form of pantheon reduction. Yahweh lost his wife, while other members of his divine council were downgraded from deities to minor divine beings, heavenly messengers, or cosmic abstractions. Cultural memories of the wife of God were twisted into the theological distortions now evident in the biblical texts in which she appears. Asherah was recast as a toxic idol, and alongside other members of the former pantheon, blamed for the disasters of earlier generations. She was held responsible for seducing Yahweh's followers away from him, prompting him to punish them with military destruction and territorial displacement. But a glimpse of the true nature of the divine couple's relationship can be found in an ancient poem in Genesis. It recycles an even older incantation into a ritual song, conveying Yahweh's blessings upon the legendary ancestor Joseph. The incantation invokes a series of deities to bestow sexual masculinity and fruitfulness upon Joseph's penis, euphemistically described as his taut bow and strong hand. Included in the divine roll call is a goddess bearing the title Breasts and Womb, a likely epithet of Asherah, given its use of Atherat, her older incarnation at Ugarit. She's paired in the poem with a deity called Father and Most High, ritual titles of the God of the Bible, inherited from Atherat's husband, Ael. From the God of your ancestor who supports you, from Shaddai who blesses you, the blessings of heaven above, the blessings of deep crouching below, the blessings of breasts and womb, the blessings of your father, warrior most high, the blessings of the everlasting mountains, the blessings of the outlying eternal hills. The coupling of father, warrior most high, and breasts and womb points to the sexualized collaboration of these deities, paralleling the pairing of heaven and deep, the divinized primeval parts of the universe, whose union birthed and built the very cosmos. The poem hints at an ancient pantheon, in which the coupling of the high god and the high goddess is set within the frame of an ordered, fertile creation. Crucially, the sexualized structuring of the cosmos was as social as it was architectural. In the religious worldviews of ancient Southwest Asian cultures, sex was not only procreative and pleasurable, but socially civilizing, binding both the universe and its inhabitants, whether divine or human, into the intense relationships by which life flourished. While a handful of these relationships in the divine realm were celibate or virginal, most were cast as the sexualized pairing of a husband and wife, father and mother, or brother and sister. Sometimes, however, a deity might take a human as a sexual partner. The God of the Bible was well acquainted with divine human sex, but at first blush, it appears to be an activity of which he firmly disapproves, as a fleeting myth in Genesis suggests. In this book's story of beginnings, the creation of humanity is swiftly followed by a series of human transgressions: eating banned fruit, the first murder, and then, worst of all, sex with gods. As humans obediently begin to fill the earth with their offspring, a group of junior deities known as the Sons of God, the members of Yahweh's divine council, find the daughters of mortal men so alluring that they take these girls for themselves and have sex with them. The girls give birth to the Nephilim, a mythical warrior race of divine human hybrids cast elsewhere in the Bible as fearsome giants. In this 5th century BCE text, the fault appears to lie not only with the predatory sons of God, but with mortal men's daughters too, whose sexual appeal is demonstrably dangerous. God is so appalled at what he describes as human wickedness that he regrets having created a now dangerously warped humanity. He decides to punish them by curbing mortal lifespans to a mere 120 years, but then quickly intensifies the penalty by resolving to kill off humans altogether. He sends the flood. This is likely a stripped-back version of a much fuller myth describing the corruption of the earliest humans. It's found in its longer form in a composition called the Book of Watchers, an early version of which is included in a text known as 1 Enoch, circa 4th century BCE. Here, the sons of God are the Watchers, a group of 200 divine beings who function as God's emissaries or angels. Unable to resist the charms of mortal women, the watchers descend from the heavens to have sex with them, but defile their holiness in the process by engaging in what is essentially depicted as cross-species sex. For the women, however, sex with these divine beings is not defiling, but enlightening. The watchers teach them the divine secrets of magic, medicine, and metallurgy, so that they can not only better harness the powers of the cosmos, but render themselves even more beautiful by making and wearing magical jewellery. Meanwhile, the giant Nephilim born to the women go on the rampage. Having gobbled up the earth's supply of food, they begin to devour humans. It's only when God's senior emissaries, the archangels Michael, Sariel, Raphael, and Gabriel, hear the cries of despair from mortal men that they ask God to intervene and rid the world of all its dangerously corrupted life forms, hence the flood. It's a story that would remain popular and alarming within ancient Jewish and early Christian circles. Indeed, by the middle of the first century CE, Paul was alluding to it when he insisted that women should keep their heads veiled or covered during prayer and prophecy on account of the angels, to prevent them from attracting the attention of the divine beings watching over worship. And by the beginning of the second century, the story had become a repeated motif in Christian teaching, warning human sinners of God's punishing ways, much as the New Testament letters of 2 Peter and Jude suggest. But God's destructive response to sex between deities and humans in Genesis and 1 Enoch is striking in view of other tales in which he engages in sex with human or human-like women himself. Clearly, the primary concern for the God of the Bible is not so much an anxiety about divine sex, nor the sexual transgression of the boundary between the human and divine worlds, but the defence of God's own and exclusive prerogative to have sex. God's first sexual encounter occurs long before the birth of the Nephilim. In the Garden of Eden, food from the sacred tree might have been off the menu, but sating sexual appetites was divinely ordained. God's pairing of Adam and Eve seemingly comes to fruition when Eve bears Cain, the first human child. But her emphatic declaration at the birth of her son credits God, not Adam, with paternity. "I have procreated a man with Yahweh." This more literal translation of the Hebrew is rarely seen. Most renderings of this verse default to a theologically fudged interpretation, so that Eve is merely presented as claiming that Yahweh has helped her to acquire a man, as any good fertility god might. But the very language of this Hebrew text signals a bodily dynamic well beyond this, for the woman's words are pointedly precise. She's claiming that Yahweh has fathered her first child. There's nothing virginal about this birth. Eve's boast is indicative of a female sexual agency wholly unlike the sanitized passivity of her later biblical antitype, the Virgin Mary. Her words reveal she's God's collaborative partner in the creation of new human life. But this proactive role also points to a long-lost mythic backstory to Eve's character. Although in her biblical form she's a human woman, her choice of vocabulary is the language of goddesses. In asserting that she has procreated a man, she uses a specialised technical term for divine reproduction, also used of goddesses in the myth from Ugarit. Indeed, like the Ugaritic goddess Atherat, Eve is called Mother of All Living, and even her name, Hava in Hebrew, likely means life-giver or living one, evoking an epithet of Atherat in her glorious title, the Lady, the Living One, the Goddess. These features of Eve's characterization in Genesis suggest that before her biblical career, she was more akin to a life-bearing goddess appropriately located in the heavenly Garden of Eden, and hence a most suitable sexual partner for a male deity. In the Bible, however, God's most significant and sexualized relationship is not with a goddess or a goddess-like figure, but with his other wife, Israel. The personification of a city, territory, nation, or social group as a woman is well attested in often masculinist, patriarchal cultures across the globe. But in the biblical texts, the female personification of Israel plays a sustained and crucial role in articulating the intense and exclusive relationship between God and his worshippers. It's a relationship so intimate that his love for them is frequently expressed in the language of sexual desire. And yet, in some books of the Hebrew Bible, the erotic tone of this imagery not only moves from the emotional to the physical, but takes on a much darker hue, casting God as a powerful sexual predator and Israel as a coquettish young girl. The book of Hosea offers a vivid example. Here, Israel is a capricious teenager whose sexual allure so intoxicates God, he falls to scheming obsessively and possessively to make her his wife. "I will now seduce her," he says of Israel. "I will take her walking into the wilderness and speak to her heart, and there she will cry out." These words betray more than the romantic fantasy of a love-struck deity. God's language here marks a shift from passion to threat. In claiming he will seduce her, he uses a Hebrew expression more usually employed in the Bible to describe the rape of captive women. And in describing Israel's vocal response, he uses a term that can convey both the noise of sexual gratification and religious joy. God's dangerous sense of sexual entitlement skews his planned attack on the girl into the distorted conviction that she'll enjoy her rape and scream in orgasmic ecstasy. This image of sexual violation is unsettling enough, but nowhere in the Bible is the portrayal of God's sex life more disturbing than in two stories in the book of Ezekiel. Like other biblical narrators, Ezekiel reasons that the military defeat and imperial subjugation that befell Yahweh's people in the 6th century BCE was a divine punishment for worshipping other gods. Here too, Israel is cast as God's wife, but her whoring after foreign deities provokes her husband's fury and punishment. According to Ezekiel, her wanton behaviour in marriage is the culmination of a long history of social and sexual deviancy. Their relationship begins in the wilderness, where God finds an abandoned baby girl, her umbilical cord still attached, deliberately cast away from the rest of humanity. "You were abhorred on the day of your birth," scorns God, as he reminds her that she had been neither washed of birth blood nor rubbed with a protective salt scrub and swaddled. And yet God acknowledges her, commanding her to live and grow. Only when she's obediently matured to puberty does he notice her again. Reminiscing lasciviously about this subsequent encounter, God comments, "Your breasts were formed, your pubic hair had grown, you were naked and bare. I passed by you and looked at you, you at the age for lovemaking. I spread the corner of my cloak over you and covered your nakedness. I pledged myself to you and entered into a covenant with you. You became mine." The voyeuristic tone to his words is not lost in this English translation, which barely manages to soften the graphic sexual nature of his actions. God's gaze is upon the girl's exposed sexual organs, moving him to cover her genitals, nakedness, with his own, his spreading cloak politely functioning here as an image of his mounting her, much as in the book of Ruth, in which the eponymous heroine urges a sleepy Boaz to have sex with her by spreading the corner of his cloak over her. The sexual euphemisms continue, for it's by penetrating the girl's body that God enters into a binding covenant with her, an unequal power relationship in which the forging of the deity's exclusive and proprietary claim to Israel is presented as the sexual consummation of a man's possession of a bride. "You became mine." Jewish and Christian interpreters have tended to soften and sanitize this encounter, either by reductive means so that the episode is merely a metaphor or allegory depicting intense religious intimacy, or by fantasizing that romantic notions of a committed, heteronormative love find their archetype in God, so that he is the paradigmatic, devoted husband. But this is wishful thinking, and it will not do. Ezekiel's story is reflective of a patriarchal, masculinist culture in which girls and women tended to be valued and defined in terms of their bodily configurations with men, as daughters, sisters, wives, mothers, or sex workers. The biblical God cannot and should not be let off the hook. Here, he's a predatory alpha male whose sexual entitlement entirely shapes the identity and fate of this displaced and vulnerable young girl. Indeed, it's only after sex that God formally rehabilitates his young bride by means of actions reminiscent of the rituals denied her at birth. He bathes her, washing away the dry blood of birth and the wet blood of puberty, and then rubs her not with salt, but with sacred oil. Her objectification continues as he dresses her in rich fabrics and puts soft leather sandals on her feet. He decorates her with earrings, a nose ring, bangles, a necklace, and crown, so that she looks like a statue of a goddess in a temple. He gives her the ritual foods commonly offered to deities, choice flour, honey, and fragrant oil, and transfers her from the wilderness to civilization, where she's rapturously celebrated for the beauty God has bestowed upon her. And here she is fixed, an unspeaking, passive ornament of her husband's hegemonic, sexualized masculinity. For God, this is a fruitful relationship. The girl gives birth to his sons and daughters, God's own worshippers. But it also results in extreme sexual violence. In a battery of fierce denunciations, the deity accuses his wife of adultery and prostitution with his rivals, the gods and kings of other nations. Adulterous wife who takes strangers instead of her husband, he spits. According to God, her sexual deviancy is so depraved that she pays her lovers for sex with the treasures received from her husband. Gifts are given to all whores, but you gave your gifts to all your lovers, bribing them to come to you from all around for your whorings. He shames her further, accusing her of being in such a permanent state of impure arousal that her vagina constantly drips with wetness. Her punishment is brutal. God gathers her lovers and strips her naked in front of them. Her legs are wrenched apart, her genitalia exposed. It's an invitation to gang rape her. A mob is summoned to stone her, cut her, stab her, and set her home alight. This scene of graphic, frenzied sexual violence is the theological money shot, for the brutality wrought against his wife triggers in God a climactic gratification by which his psychosexual anger suddenly appears spent. Thus I will satisfy my fury on you, and my jealousy shall turn away from you. I will be calm and will be angry no longer. Once she's learned her lesson, he'll take her back. In a parallel narrative, a few chapters later, God again looks back on his alleged cuckolding with venomous fury. This time, Israel is personified as two sisters, Ohola and Oholibah, who represent the cities Samaria and Jerusalem. Their sexual crimes, God claims, begin even before he makes them his brides. In their youth, they seek out the Egyptians, cast as animalized foreigners with penises like those of donkeys and gushing semen like that of stallions, who squeeze and fondle the young girl's breasts and ejaculate over them. Even so, God marries them. But the sisters' sexual depravity only worsens, so much so they seek out lovers who disgust them and even sacrifice to those lovers the children they have borne their divine husband. God's violent response is again profoundly disturbing. He gathers his wives' lovers, who strip the sisters naked and abuse them. Ohola's children are seized, and she's put to death by the sword. Her younger sister, Oholibah, endures a more prolonged suffering. God again summons her lovers, instructing them to disfigure his unfaithful wife by cutting off her nose and ears, to expose her genitalia, and to burn her children. God then gives his wife, her dead sister's cup of desolation and horror, commanding her to drink until she's intoxicated with such sorrowful shame that the cup will shatter in her hands. In a startling image of self-harm wrought by abuse, God decrees she will use its jagged pieces to mutilate herself, gnawing on its shards and hacking off her breasts. Most damaging of all, perhaps, is the moral of the tale. The fate of God's wife is explicitly exhibited in this narrative as a warning to all women, lest they too dishonour their husbands. These horrifying tales in the book of Ezekiel have proved deeply troubling for many readers, past and present, secular and religious. As endorsements, albeit ancient ones, of male sexual predation, exploitation, and misogynistic violence, the value systems evoked in these narratives ostensibly conflict sharply with those of the modern West. They not only degrade and vilify female sexuality, but enshrine the sexual and domestic abuse of girls and women with ongoing biblical authority. Theologically, the sexual grooming and graphic violence God inflicts on his young wife is immensely difficult for some modern-day believers to reconcile with their idealized constructs of God. But for many Jewish and Christian readers, it's more specifically the graphic portrayal of a sexually active deity that has proved unbearable. It's been mistranslated, dismissed as mere allegory, or simply ignored. Indeed, by the 2nd century CE, the story of God having sex with his pubescent bride in Ezekiel was banned by the rabbis from public reading in the synagogue. A ruling attributed to Rabbi Eliezer in about 100 CE, who was said to have interrupted a man reading aloud the opening words of the story, "Mortal, proclaim to Jerusalem her abominations," with a sarcastic rebuke, "Why don't you go out and proclaim the abominations of your mother?" For the ancient rabbis, there was no pretense that the lurid, explicit portrayal of divine human sex was simply symbolic. Ezekiel's story was simultaneously a metaphor and a mythological truth, revealing the torrid nature of the physical relationship between the mother of the people and their God. Better to censor it entirely than to repeat aloud its shocking truths. By contrast, almost all the early church fathers refused to recognize the sexualized, gendered bodies of God and Israel in these biblical narratives, even while relying on their corporeal imagery to teach Christians about the concrete bodily realities of sin and salvation. Origen was staggered by the implication that Ezekiel presents a vision of the corporeality of God and his wife. "It said to me, 'Don't allegorize, don't explain figuratively,'" he complained. "Let them give an opinion on this," I ask. "Jerusalem has breasts, and at one time they are not bound, and at another they are made firm, and she has an umbilical cord and is reproached because it was not cut. How is it possible to understand these things without allegorical interpretation?" Origen's approach to these difficult texts would dominate subsequent Christian readings for centuries. In spite of a confessional commitment to the incarnate reality of the divine body of Christ, church theologians remained incredulous that God's body was ever in full sexualized view in the book of Ezekiel. These older forms of resistance reading in Jewish and Christian circles continue today. In standard modern translations of the Tanakh and the Christian Bible, the graphic sexual imagery of these troubling texts is softened or obscured with sanitized vocabulary and clunky euphemisms, theologically veiling their portrayal of a sexually active God. But for the ancient writers of biblical books, God was so familiarly corporeal, masculine, and sexual that these characteristics were easily harnessed to tell the story of his intense and turbulent relationship with his people Israel, a people he expected to desire, love, and obey him as a good wife should. In the eyes of the biblical writers, God's traditional wife, Asherah, might have been cast aside, but he himself retained his position as a divine husband and wedded himself instead to his worshippers. This is why early Christians could so easily conjure the image of Christ as their heavenly bridegroom. It was deeply embedded in their religious DNA. As early as the mid-first century CE, Paul was telling Christians in Corinth that they were promised in marriage to one husband, as a chaste virgin to Christ. Similarly, in his letter to the Christian community in Rome, Paul casts the intimate relationship between Christ and his church as the fertile, bodily union of a husband and wife, an image later extended in the book of Revelation and the epistle to the Ephesians to describe the church as Christ's bride. Both these texts draw on Ezekiel's portrayal of God dressing up his young wife like a goddess statue to describe the sexual allure of Christ's bride. But in Ephesians, the parallels are disturbingly pronounced. Here, Christ not only cleanses and beautifies his bride to render her more desirable and holy, but the stark power imbalance of divine-human marriage is used as a paradigm for mortal marriages. For the husband is the head of the wife, just as Christ is the head of the church. Just as the church is submissive to Christ, so also wives are to be, in everything, to their husbands. These and other early Christian texts would authoritatively endorse the self-portrayal of the church as the bride of Christ for at least the next 1,000 years. This was a marriage supposedly ordained by Jesus himself, who in the New Testament Gospels refers to himself as the bridegroom of his followers. But in other ancient Christian texts, Mary Magdalene appears to play the bridal role of the church itself. In both the Gospel of Mary, 2nd century CE, and the Gospel of Philip, early 3rd century CE, she's cast as the disciple Jesus loves the most. She is his beloved and his consort, with whom he not only shares his most authoritative, esoteric teachings, but his physical affection in the form of kisses, much to the irritation of the other disciples. While attempts to argue that Mary Magdalene was originally the wife of Jesus have repeatedly proved unpersuasive, scholars are broadly agreed that she was celebrated in nascent Christianity as a crucial player in the early Jesus movement. Not only was she perceived to have been a prominent member of Jesus' inner circle, but she was held by some to have been commissioned by the newly risen Christ to teach the other disciples about his divinity and his heavenly kingdom. Her elevated status in the Gospels of Mary and Philip reflects the continued potency of these early traditions in some Eastern Empire communities, in which she was revered as a great leader of the church. But as the scholar April Deconic shows, growing anxieties about the religious authority of women, coupled with increasing conflicts between churches in the Roman East and West, led to her marginalisation. Eventually, in what would come to be more prominent theological traditions, she would be cast as a prostitute. Like Asherah and Eve before her, Mary Magdalene was overwhelmingly disempowered by her deliberate denigration as the embodiment of sexual deviancy. The life-giving virility of Christ and his bodily commitment to his church was vividly drawn on much older biblical models of divine marriage and the masculinized, corporeal sexuality of God. Throughout the Bible, God engages in sexualized or eroticized relationships with a variety of female or feminized consorts. Some are deliberately marginalised and vilified, others are cast in the subordinate role of unruly or obedient bride. All were subjected to a series of theological distortions later wrought by a misogynistic monotheism, making space for the continued degrading of the sexualised female body, whether human or divine, in the religious systems the Bible would come to shape. But at the heart of God's relationships with these consorts, even if at times deeply suppressed, was a complex of ancient ideas in which cosmic creation mapped onto genital generation, divine corporeality mapped onto human physicality, religious awe mapped onto erotic allure, and spiritual intensity mapped onto sexual intimacy. On the body of the biblical God, the divine penis was more than an accessory of patriarchal masculinity. It was the corporeal manifestation of the divine thrust of all life, heavenly and earthly, cultural and social, in the cosmos.